Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Moores. And with me this week, I have Nigel Redwood. Hello.
Hi, Sam. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. Very thanks. Can you tell the audience a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Nigel Redwood. I head up the sales and marketing and commercial activities at Revolution Race Cars. So responsible for everything from go-to-market car sales, arrive and drive in terms of race participation, looking after the dealers around the world, and helping coordinate all the race series around the world too.
Nice. How did this sort of journey start? Have you been in the automotive space all your life? Or
I've been in motorsport, I would say, for a very long time, but not necessarily predominantly as my main career. Actually, my background is one of being a CEO of a technology business, an AIM-listed business. But during that time, in the early 2000s, I raced, and one of the cars I raced was Radicals. And that's when I got to know Phil Abbott, who is the founder of Revolution Race Cars. Yeah. So when I came out of the technology industry, Phil approached me and asked if I'd be interested in having a test of a Revolution, but secondly, if I'd like to help him at Revolution in terms of on the commercial side, and it's come from there really. So,
interesting. So way back when you first started doing some racing, were you exclusively racing Radicals, or did you race a bit of stuff? And what drew you to them in the first place?
Yeah, racing a number of things over the years. So started in Formula Ford. And actually, how I got involved with Radical was that I was racing for Martin Donnelly, so MDR Racing back in the day. And when Martin got the approval from the FIA to go racing again, he chose Radicals as the car to do it. So I was racing for his Formula Ford team, and he said, hey, do you fancy coming and doing a race with me? It was his first race back off, obviously, after his accident at F1, and so I didn't know what car it was going to be, and it turned out to be Radical, and it went from there really. So I absolutely loved racing those cars, so I ended up doing a full season, well, a couple of seasons in Radical. I won the championship in 2006.
Nice.
And then after that I did British GT as well, so a whole different spectrum of racing from single seater all the way through to GT cars.
And was that in the extremely lucky position of paid for by someone else, or was it somewhere in the middle?
Somewhere in the middle, yeah. So it was a bit of a combination where, certainly in GT racing anyway, if you could set up the car and bring some coaching skills, then you bought less money than the other people you were racing with. So it was never completely free, but certainly didn't have to bring the full budget at the time.
Wasn't too bad. What was GT racing like, and how did it sort of compare to the sort of prototype stuff?
It's completely different. So I raced a Porsche 911 and then a Dodge Viper. And actually, out of those two, the Dodge Viper was an incredible car to race. You know, when you look at those cars, they're incredibly agricultural and very straightforward. Yeah. But as a result, we're very predictable in terms of setup and performance. So you could actually set them up very well to each circuit and extract a lot of performance from them. So really good, but very different to prototypes. You know, obviously prototypes are all about a high degree of downforce and performance. So a very different driving style. You know, with a GT cars, you have a little bit of downforce, but nothing in comparison to prototypes and something like a Revolution.
How would you say that difference? Like, what are you doing differently in a more of a downforce, lightweight thing to a GT car?
I guess with a downforce car, it's about learning. You have to be a little bit smoother, I would say, and it's about learning actually how much speed you can take through the high speed corners. I mean, with a high downforce car, if you're not driving near the limit, actually it feels a little bit harder to drive and a little bit slower. So you almost have to take yourself a little bit past the limit in order to then start to really feel the effects of the downforce car. But Revolution have done their aero package really nicely on that front. They've spent a lot of time making sure that the aero and the downforce is actually exploitable from any type of driver, really, from your pro driver right the way through to your novice driver, can exploit the downforce quite nicely. And, you know, if you do start to get the car sideways, the downforce stays really consistent, so it doesn't just suddenly go. And, you know, some downforce cars, the minute you get the car a little bit sideways, it will, you know, the airflow changes and you lose the downforce and spin. At Revolution, they've spent a long time making sure that actually the downforce works, you know, in a number of angles. So it's a very forgiving car from that perspective.
How do you approach that? Because I think that was one of the things with sort of my driving that I had in the back of my mind. It was like, right, yeah, okay, you're going really fast, you're pushing it. But what happens, because in your head, I know if you get a certain amount of sideways, you lose a lot of the downforce and then like, see ya. How do you approach building a car to make downforce at angles other than straight ahead?
Well, you're probably asking the wrong person, actually, because a lot of time is spent with CFD modeling the aero from that perspective. And, you know, that looks at drag, but also, you know, how the aero is applied to the car, depending on the direction of the force and the wind is coming. So I think with the use of CFD, you can spend a lot of time remodeling the aerodynamics of a car with all of those types of things in consideration. I mean, if you're just using purely a wind tunnel, then, you know, the limited amount of time you've got in that, but also you're remodeling everything in physical terms is much more difficult. Whereas with CFD, you can spend a lot of time over and over and over and making sure that the model works. And then it will be down to, you know, does that translate on the track once it's built?
Yeah, I'd never really thought about it. They modeling not linear forward backwards, because when you ever see a wind tunnel, it's always just the cars lined up, the smoke's going over it, and I never thought in this really about, obviously cars are dynamic and they don't necessarily travel forward. They might have an angle on. In an ideal, they have an angle on. Even in the perfect world, you've got a couple of degrees of slip in your tires and stuff. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I mean, a four-wheel slip and drift is the quickest way around the corner, right? And so you've got to build that into the area model. And the guys at Revolution have done that so well. And it's one thing that anyone that jumps in the car says that, you know, actually they kind of expected a real high downforce. You know, if they've come from a no downforce car or low down to this, they kind of expect you get into it and it just drives like it's on rails. But the reality is a car on the edge never drives like it's on rails. Yeah. You're always driving it on the edge in that nature. And they all say just how predictable the car is at that point, you know, when it gets to that point where it begins to move. And you watch some of the onboard footage, you know, when someone's really driving a quick lap, you can actually see how the wheel and the car is all reacting at the corner entry and midpoint and exit. And they're really rewarding to drive on that front.
Yeah, because I imagine a lot of people, and myself included, like before getting in a high downforce car, or the first time you get in one, or when you start getting used to them, you see something like F1, especially modern F1, and it just looks like they just turn in and they go around the corner and then off they go. And you're like, well, that's how it is. The reality is they are incredible and they are right on that limit, but they've got it so that they're not correcting. Like, you know, they're not correcting, but if they were a little bit worse, you would see the small movements, and those cars are probably are much more sensitive to getting it wrong.
And the reality is they probably are, you know, as you say, the steering is so sensitive in a car like that, they probably are just minuscule correcting at all points when it's no big movement like this, but they are correcting mid-corner, no doubt, I would think.
Yeah, and like when you get into a car like the Revolution or for the first time, how long do you think it takes the typical person that comes for a test to like get over the fact it is what it is?
Yeah, and it really is different. So I'll give you an example. At Silverstone, we had a driver called Jonathan Mitchell in the car. That was his first race weekend, and in a Revolution. And he'd come from historic, so he'd done a lot of historic racing. So he raced an E-Type, which of course has got no downforce whatsoever. Done a lot of Caterhams and things like that. So he's obviously driven cars that have a lot of movement, but he'd never necessarily driven a car with a high degree of downforce. I think he had actually driven one prototype car, but it was an historic prototype. So again, completely different. And he got in the car and he was straight away up to speed, and so much so up to speed. The second race, he won outright.
Nice.
So in the ZO prototype challenge and the sports prototype cup, he won outright in front of all the other manufacturers. So there was things like Pragas, there was Radicals, obviously other Revolutions and things. So that's a really good example of a very good experienced driver in something that hasn't got downforce, has jumped in a Revolution and just been able to exploit it. And, he had the test day on the Friday, and it was qualifying in two races on the Saturday. And you just saw his confidence build from Friday onwards. So he's probably an example of the quickest person I've seen get up to speed with it. Whereas it can take others a little bit more time, but that's an example of, you know, if you're racing a lot and you jump in it, normally people can get up to speed with it quickly.
Yeah. And like you said, the cars are drivable. Like they're not, it's just got more grip. You've just got more grip, but it still drives like a normal car, but like they do.
Yeah.
It's just quicker.
And if you look at our customer base, we've got such a wide varied levels of experience. So we've got, in total now we've sold about 44 cars around the world, and we've got customers that have never raced and haven't got a race license, right the way up to kind of people that are on the journey to Le Mans and want to be a professional driver. And if you take the guys that never raced before, for example, so with those guys, we'll do them a package whereby we'll say, okay, we can sell you the car, but we'll also do you a kind of an 18-month program of track day time where We will help you. We will help you get the most out of the car during that period with coaching. We'll run the car so you don't have to worry about finding a team to run it. So we'll run the car, we'll prep the car, we'll take it to an agreed number of events for you, and we will, you know, we'll provide a driver coach and someone to help you through on that journey to the point where you're then ready to enter a race and things like that. So we've got a couple of customers going on journeys like that. And you'd think, wow, if you've never raced before, why would you choose, you know, why would you choose a Revolution? But
yeah,
you know, actually one of the big advantages of something like a Revolution is that it is a two-seater car.
Right.
So, you know, you can have a driver coach sitting next to you. You've got all the driver aids and all the data, much more so than in probably lesser class cars. So, I mean, one of the big philosophies of Phil when he was designing the Revolution was to kind of bring LMP standards down to national and club motorsport. So that means, you know, the car's got a whole number of different throttle maps, a whole number of different traction control maps, all adjustable on the steering wheel. And actually that makes it absolutely ideal for people just getting into racing, because they can easily tune from the steering wheel all of the driving techniques to really get to help them get to up to speed with the car, even down to, for example, the power assistant steering. You can change how light it is or how heavy it is and things like that. So two seats, very forgiving aero configuration, all this technology to help the driver. It actually means for kind of people new to motorsport, it gives them a very wide set of tools to really help them race. And then on the other end, you've got kind of your semi-pro drivers that are trying to get to LMP and make a career in motorsport. The car is absolutely ideal for them, because, you know, that from a setup perspective, the window is so massive in terms of what you can do with it. Performance-wise, you know, it's very close to LMP3 lap times. But for a fraction of the cost, really.
Yeah.
And also the one of the big philosophies of the car was to really make sure that you've got long intervals on rebuilds and things like that.
So, right, okay.
You know, people can get into it and run them for a long period without having to kind of consistently rebuilding the engine and things like that on a regular basis. So for the guys that are heading towards a Le Mans type trajectory, they're great cars because they can do a lot of miles in them and so on and so forth without, you know, really having a substantial rebuild cost or number of rebuild costs during the year.
Interesting. What sort of things, like looking at that, like the ability to run it for a long time without between rebuilds and what sort of things have been designed and built in to enable that?
Well, I mean, the whole design of the car has got some really clever innovations, really. And they're probably simple when you talk about them. Well, they seem simple, but they're very rarely found on a race car. So,
right.
For example, you know, a race team kind of running a car like that, you want to try and minimize the amount of spares that they hold, for example, because okay. All of that obviously contributes to your budget throughout the year. So what we've done is make the same parts reusable around the car. So, okay. For example, there'll be bits on each corner that is exactly the same on all four parts of the car, but they just turn around and a flip depending on
side
it is. So instead of having to have four bits for each corner, you carry one bit and you know you've got that part for all four corners of the car. So it's innovations like that that really help a team in terms of their budget and things like that. So when the car's been sat down and planned, it is all about, you know, how can we extend the life of things like that and help. So it's the same in terms of engine and gearbox. You know, we're not running the engine and gearbox to the absolute limit where it's, you know, it's all slightly tuned back to make sure that it's got a good life and things like that. That said, we're still extracting 500 horsepower from an engine that starts with probably 300 odd horsepower.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's we haven't taken things right to the edge, to the knife edge, purposely to make sure that they, you know, things are reliable and you can get good life and mileage out of the car.
So yeah, talking about the engine, what things I'm interested to know. Yeah, one, what have you done to the engine? What is it? It's, I know it's a Ford V6, but presumably modified a reasonable amount.
Yeah, so we do take a Ford V6 crate engine and do a number of different things to it. And ultimately, we're taking it from 280 horsepower stock all the way up to 500 horsepower on the 500 SE. So the guys do a number of things to the engine to achieve that. So the stock oil pump's removed, and it's replaced with our own bespoke dry sump system. And that actually does something really important. It lowers the center of gravity on the engine by about 63 millimeters.
Quite a lot.
And that allows to get the engine to sit a lot lower in the car, which obviously helps with the weight distribution and handling. The stock intake's removed and replaced with a plenum and manifold from ourselves, and the cast exhaust are removed and replaced with tubular manifolds, again, all around focusing on performance. We've just introduced a new clutch system to it, actually, so a centrifugal clutch to it. So essentially that enables someone to jump in the car and have a true two-pedal experience. So in a normal race car, you've got three pedals, a clutch, yeah. and you pull off in first gear using the clutch, and then you're not using the clutch, yeah, to change it through the gears. Now you can actually pull off without even needing the clutch.
Oh, nice.
It's a bit like a go-kart from that perspective.
Okay, and it's not on a clutch paddle.
No, so it's still it's not on a clutch paddle at all. So you've still got the paddles behind the steering wheel to change gears. So you press a button to say that you're going to select a gear. You select a gear, and then the clutch doesn't kind of engage drive until you get to a certain number of revs. So you just put your foot on the accelerator, rev, and it pulls off.
Yeah, nice.
And actually, that has a number of advantages. One, it helps protect the engine. So yeah. If you spin, for example, yeah, in a supercharged car and the engine runs backwards, you can damage the engine or the supercharger if you don't dip the clutch. With this type of clutch system, it just dips for you automatically. Nice. So again, kind of with the idea that we're trying to get our customers to have limited number of rebuilds and longevity, just innovations like that help protect the engine from that perspective. And also the other advantage is it's just a very consistent pull off. So, you know, if you've got a driver that's really revving the engine to pull off, it's obviously going to wear through the clutch much more quickly. Whereas with something like this, you're just pulling off and you know, it's exactly the same each time. So again, it makes the clutch life much more predictable and things like that.
Can you do a standing start?
Yeah. You can do a standing start. Yeah, absolutely.
So how does that work?
So you literally have your foot on the brake, and as soon as the lights go out, you'll just floor it, and it will do the rest for you. The reality is in prototype racing, they're always rolling starts.
Yeah, so it's not a problem.
But you can still do a burnout if you really want to.
Yeah.
And then the other bits, we obviously had a supercharger to the 500. The stock water pump's removed and we replace it with twin water pumps. And again, that enables us to mount the engine closer to the tub by about 70 millimeters, which again helps with weight distribution. So not only are we lowering the engine, but we're also getting it closer to the tub. And then everything's fully ported and the engine balanced by we use our RLM to do that. So it takes it to about 500 horsepower in total.
And what weight is that?
The engine or the car, the car itself. So probably the more important stat on that will be kind of the power to rate ratio. So power to rate ratio is about 599 brake horsepower to the ton.
Pretty quick. So,
yeah. So in total, it's about 830 kilograms, which works out about 599 brake horsepower per ton. But what we're doing at the moment actually is going through a weight reduction program. We want to try and get that under 800 kilograms. It's already class leading in terms of brake horsepower per ton anyway. So, you know, if you look at radicals or LMPs or things like that, then we're already doing really well on that anyway. But we still want to reduce it, lighten it up further.
Yeah, and then the sort of front rear weight balance, bias, whatever the correct term is. Is it rear a bit, presumably?
Yeah, rear slightly. But again, because we wanted to make the car extremely drivable, what you don't want is, you know, a lot more weight over the rear, and you kind of create that pendulum effect. Yeah. So again, when you've got the car on the edge and you're playing that, getting the car to dance, you want it to be predictable. So the car is designed to be as neutral as possible from that front.
Yeah, and presumably it actually being rear a little bit, if you're looking at doing sort of up the racing tree and you want to go P3, P2, whatever, they're all rear a little bit, I believe. So you're learning to deal with that setup that you will be dealing with as you go up. Rather than, like, I think my SR3 is like pretty in the middle. And I noticed I had to go in a revolution a while ago now, I don't know, 2 years ago maybe. And it did feel a little bit more back. Like, you definitely had to, I guess you have to drive them slightly differently. But you had a significant amount more shove than my SR3, which down the straights is for good.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at like the Gs that are generated, for example, you get about 1G in acceleration. So it really is a big shove when, and then if you combine that kind of with the lateral G-force of, you're getting close to 3G, and it's up at about 2.8, 2.9. The forces that go through your body. I mean, I raced an SR3 back in the day, and they were fantastic cars, but it's taking the kind of the forces on your body to another level of the revolution.
And I imagine like a lot of the, do you have a lot of American customers or people that have,
we do. So
a club type situation.
Yeah. So America is actually our biggest market at the moment. So out of the 44, 45 cars we've sold, like 23, 24 of those have gone to the States already. Yeah. And you've got, kind of two markets over there. So as you say, you've got these country clubs, which are fantastic things. So you've got amazing racetracks that are kind of, you have to be a member to race there.
Yeah.
And a lot of these country clubs, you can buy a plot of land and have a house and a garage on the side. So these guys will keep their cars there and then jump in and run them.
Happy days.
And again, back to what we focus on in terms of making them reliable and run for a long time, you know, great for those country club type customers because they can, you know, jump in and go lap after lap. So we're working with three dealers in the States. So we've got a dealer in Texas in the middle of the country, on the East Coast, and then on the West Coast. So we've got kind of three dealers that we're trying to cover all of the states with, and naturally kind of those country clubs are good markets for them. And then we've got guys that want to race, you know, so we started the Sports Prototype Cup North America, so that these guys, if they want to race competitively, they can. So I'd probably say about a third of the customers that have bought Revolutions, about a third of them use them to race over there, whereas the others are kind of using them at these country clubs and track days and things like that. But I actually think the Sports Prototype Cup North America, it's got some of the best tracks. If I have a quick look and just tell you the tracks that they've gone to. So they did Road Atlanta, then Sonoma, then Laguna Seca. They've got Mid-Ohio in a week or so's time, then Road America, then Virginia International Raceway, then Spring Mountain, and then they finished the year at COTA. So some of the most amazing circuits. America are kind of spoilt really in terms of, I think, for for the sports prototype kit North America. They've just got such a good timetable. So it's a big market for us.
I don't know I wouldn't say I necessarily know my American tracks very well, but I think I've heard of all of those pretty much. So they must be at least a certain level of, you know, international fame to have come over here to someone that's not been over there driving.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What's the sort of, is your pitch or the reason why someone might, you'd sort of try and get someone in a Revolution rather, you know, okay, we've both done some radical racing and they're still around. What might be some advantages of getting in a Revolution versus an SR3 or something?
I think the Revolution is just taking everything a step forward. So, you know, if you just start with the tub, for example, mm-hmm. you know, it's a full carbon fiber tub. So it makes it incredibly light, but incredibly strong at the same time. So straight away, safety is a big plus point, especially in the States. And we're just breaking into Australia as well. So again, safety is really important. So, you know, a full carbon fiber safety cell is much more safe and strong than, you know, a steel space frame, for example. So I think, you know, a lot of the people that are making a jump to a Revolution, certainly in the States, that does come into the decision. I think the other side is the technology and the downforce. You know, we've already talked about how everything's kind of a little bit on steroids, from everything from kind of the 1G acceleration through to how it brakes and handles. And then the technology to really back that up, you know, the different throttle maps and the adjustable power assisted steering, the traction control, you know, all things like that that can be refined from within the cockpit, really attracts drivers to it, really. You know, they can really enjoy and extract a lot of performance out of it. And then the final thing, the lap times, you know, the speed is what it's all about, isn't it? And, you know, when you can lap close to LMP times, LMP3 times, I should say, then it becomes attractive at this price point. So, you know, people moving from Radical to Revolution, I think, take all those types of things into account. I mean, what I would say is that we're still building all the race series around the world and things like that. So I think as the years go on, actually the level of competition will increase. You know, right now, if I look at the Sports Prototype North America, there's two or three guys that are having some great battles over there. But you want that to be 15, 20 people that are having it. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, they're getting good grids. But I think in time, as more and more people move into something like a Revolution, then the competition will get the driving competition will get higher, and that will then attract more people. So right now, it's the car that's doing all the attraction. But I think also the race series will begin to do that as well over time.
Yeah, the safety thing. I feel like that's the sort of easy sell to everyone. Is you go, if you're coming into this space, let's just say you're someone that's got lots of money, and you're like, I would like to do some serious looking racing. When I started getting into this, it was like, I want to drive something that's not like a road car. Like, I had a nice fast road car, and I was like, okay, I want something that's faster and a bit different and maybe some downforce. And that's how I sort of ended up in my route. But I can see Radicals, I think there's a problem at the moment where they've introduced a Halo, and everyone knows Halo is better. Like, it's safer, but it's slower. And the weight, like just putting it in the car and whatever, and having the option of not running it or running it, you might choose to run it, but you know that you've added a bunch of weight up and it's going to be slower. So you've got that question. In the Revolution, it's been built in from the beginning. You don't have the choice. They've all got it. So that removes that side, which is sort of an element.
Yeah. And you know, we were the first to do kind of this double Halo design. And, you know, and the whole car is FIA tested from a front crash structure, the roll protection, the safety cell, the fuel cell, all FIA crash tested. So, you know, we haven't kind of put stuff on the car and said it's going to be more safe. These have been stringently tested, and you know, it's a big part of the design, the exceeding the standards to make sure that our guys can go racing as safely as possible, but also as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and with a carbon tub, presumably there's lots of benefits of having a carbon tub. Do you have to repair them very often? I feel like carbon tubs are one of the things that they take a lot of abuse, but if they get to the point where they've broken, you're almost glad. You're like, oh, I'm kind of glad. Like,
yeah,
I'll pay for a new tub. At least I'm here.
It incredibly rarely, and I say incredibly rarely. I think we've had one client that's needed to replace a tub after an accident, and it was a massive accident. They're so strong and stiff. The whole idea is the rest of the car crumples around you in an accident, and the tub stays absolutely solid and safe, protecting the driver. For example, in the opening round of the Canadian Championship, there was an accident whereby a revolution came over the crest of the hill, and there was a Formula car stationary sideways in the middle of the road, and the revolution went into it, and the car that it went into actually landed on top of the halo. And the driver and the race team said, in any other car that would have been an absolute disaster, both in terms of kind of injury and the car. As it was in the revolution, the driver was absolutely fine, and there wasn't a massive amount of damage to the revolution. There was a front end, and that was pretty much the limit of it, so it does make a difference when the safety cell and the halo is all designed in as one kind of safety unit from the very start and built into the design and the whole ethos of the car. Absolutely, it just they're as safe as they can be, really.
Yeah, that's one of those sort of situations that you're like, it's kind of good PR and bad PR. It's like, these things can happen racing, that's a negative. But the car was completely fine and the driver was completely fine, that's a plus.
Absolutely, and that's the reality, isn't it? Everyone knows that, sport racing is, to a degree, dangerous. You do risk yourself when you go in, and I think what we can do is, we give our clients the best possible chance that they can go racing and be as safe. You just look at how F1 has evolved over the years, and the accidents that happen in F1 now, and they walk away. This is exactly the same. We want to take club motorsport or national motorsport, and we've elevated the safety standards as far as absolutely possible, so that people can enjoy racing for a very long time.
Yeah, a friend of mine drives an LMP3 car, and he had a crash the other day, which was so horrific. He was driving down the start-finish straight at the end of a race, and for some reason, no one knows, the car in front of him, just before crossing the line, like lifted off.
Yeah.
And he was like on his bumper, and he basically went into the back of him, went sideways, and went straight into the wall at like big, 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 big speed. And the tub.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In front of his feet, like, was basically destroyed.
Wow. His feet are still there and the pedals are still there, but there was like a big ass hole in front. And you're like, oh, I'm glad I was in a carbon tub, but like, geez, oh.
Yeah. And it, you know, carbon's an amazing thing. You know, when you look at how, I can't remember what the stat is, but James Abbott in the factory told me something about you could, you know, literally put drop a London bus on top of it, and it would just take it.
So, yeah. And what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which does highlight how big some of these forces are. When you see damage, you're like, oh yeah, driving into a wall at 140 miles an hour. Funnily enough, like, it's amazing that people can walk away. Like, you see some of the insane F1 crashes, you know, like, they walked away.
Yeah, and you know, and you capture all the G-forces now in an accident through the data, and so you can see some of the forces that go through. And you know, even when one of our customers has a small accident, you know, we ask that the data get sent back to the factory. The factory are looking through that data to look at, you know, what forces did go through certain elements and things like that, so we can make any recommendations. And it is amazing how much force is generated in accidents, no matter how big and quick the accident is. There's still substantial forces going on.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important to, you know, to have these types of carbon fiber safety cells, you know, because it doesn't matter how big your accident is, you know, a small one can still be a big one in reality.
Yeah, it's that classic, like, I've heard people say, like, oh, why do you need a carbon helmet? And you're like, I don't know. How much do you value your head? Until you need it, like, yeah, fine. But anyway,
yeah, it's a bit similar to Hans devices. So when I was racing in 2005 or 2004, you know, the Hans device had just come in.
Right.
It was actually my partner that said, we watched the documentary on the Hans device and how it's developed. And we sat there and watched that, and the minute it finished, she went, you're not going racing again without a Hans device. And it was just like, and then they weren't mandatory and very few people were wearing them. And you think now it's
awkward.
You think now no one even thinks twice about putting a Hans device on. And, you know, no one should think twice about getting in a carbon safety cell in reality, should they, you know?
Yeah, I think if you can afford it, like, if you're going to do the racing and, you know, people racing all sorts of stuff, but in the sort of speeds involved in any racing, really, it's slightly worrying how fast you can go in something that is really slow. Especially, like, look at all the classic races. Like, they're still going fast. They just don't stop very quickly.
Forgivingly, neither.
The one which I feel like should be called a Hans device, that I did a little bit of MX5, and I did a race, and then I saw that everyone had these straps around their arms, and I was like, what's that? They're like, oh yeah, you put these straps around your arms, because if you don't and you roll over or something, fly out of the window and then just get crushed against a wall. And they're like, yeah, that guy over there, he's only got one arm because his arm went out. And you're like, oh, sorry, what?
they strap it to the lap belt, don't they? So they strap it into your arm so you can, like, when I first saw that, because they in the States, they make that mandatory. And this year I was lucky enough to race at Laguna Seca in the sports prototype.
Oh, nice.
North America. And I'd never seen those. And we were going through scrutineering and they were like, oh, have you got these restraints? I was just like, what? You know?
Yeah.
And I had to go and borrow some off another driver because, you know, I'd never heard of them. But yeah, they all wear, any open cockpit over there, you have to have these things. And, you know, you'd think that it would actually restrict your movement, but it doesn't at all. It restricts you putting your hand up in the air, but when you're driving, it doesn't restrict your movement at all. So all these types of developments, they can't be bad. They're looking after us.
And I've never used them in a radical. And I sort of did that experience, got back in the radical, and then looked at it again and went like, should I be wearing these in the radical? And I think you immediately justify why you're not doing it, because you haven't brought any with you and you're not wearing them. And you go, well, I'm a lot deeper in the car. Like, I'm a lot deeper in the car. It's not like I can just put my hand out the window like that. I'd have to raise it up at least 6 inches before it could go out of the car. How was racing at Laguna Seca?
Absolutely amazing. Although the promised weather of California didn't materialize. It was freezing. We were there for 4 days. We got there on the Thursday. And so they've got a brilliant format over there. They They have testing on the Thursday, they do a quali on the Friday, and then they race Saturday and Sunday. But also the Sunday morning, they have an hour enduro. So they have two sprint races, one on the Saturday, one on the Sunday. They have an hour enduro on the Sunday morning as well. Yeah. So race time wise, you know, seat time wise, fantastic. They get a load of seat time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. The circuit is, I mean, even driving into the circuit is daunting. Have you been?
I've been just as a random person and watched some stuff there.
So you turn in, and you know the drive up to get into the paddock is kind of up this windy hill with big drops off the side, and you're driving and everything. Where's the circuit? You know. So even just to get in the place is daunting. And then you know, obviously the famous turn is the corkscrew. And I'd say your stomach does go the first two times you go down it. You do. You know, your stomach goes a little bit the first couple of times you go down there. So, really fantastic track.
And what's it like in something like a Revolution? Because presumably you don't have – your vision's, like, not that good in a car like that, and dropping off steeply down a hill. Like, are you just planted at that point? You're like, I've got to go somewhere towards some trees over there?
I mean, you kind of pick – you're right, you pick a tree to aim at, but it falls away pretty quickly, so you do actually see it, you know, you do actually see it really quickly. I'd probably say at Donington, coming onto the back straight, you probably see a little bit less there, you know, compared to the corkscrew. So as you're coming up to the corkscrew, you're in your braking zone, and you can see your first apex, so you know if you're going to get your first apex soon, the track drops away and you see the second apex. So it's not as bad as
not just cruising up, front end wheeling along.
But yeah, absolutely fun. And if you walk up it and have a look at it's a little bit like Zandvoort. You don't really realise how banked the banking is until you walk on it, and it's a bit the same at the corkscrew. Yeah. You know, it's much steeper if you just walk it as opposed to sit in the car through it.
I was there to take some photos, but I think I had about 45 minutes there, so I just legged it on the inside. I was like, okay, I've got to do some for the pits, and then you run all the way up to the hill, and you're like, I'm at the top of the hill, and then there's another car come past and you're running around. You're like, oh, this is quite intense. It does also feel like really old and backwards, if that makes sense. Like, there's like nothing there.
And in fact, like, all of the little towns around it the same. So all of the restaurants closed at 9 o'clock at night. All of them close at nine. So, and you know, you go to a race meeting and we're there with the factory, and quite regularly you'll be at the racetrack past 9 o'clock, won't you? Yeah. Prepping the car and getting ready. So the first night that we kind of prepped the car, we all stayed back. We went back to the hotel expecting to be able to get a meal. And every single restaurant's closed after 9 o'clock. It's just like, what? You know, and that kind of just sums the place up, really. It's all just a little bit, you know, relaxed and a little bit dated, but in a nice way.
Yeah, and it feels historic.
Oh, yeah, you do. You kind of get that tingling when you drive in, and you come in and you look over, you can see the pit and paddock complex, and you can see they've got like the corkscrew in writing, a bit like Hollywood, haven't they, on the side? Very American. It just feels really good. I mean, interesting, we were there, the race meeting we were at was meant to be the first race meeting where the new race surface would have been used.
Right.
As it was, I think we were the last meeting that used the old surface, so it's still very bumpy. Nice. And, you know, so yeah, incredibly, for us, it was an incredibly bumpy circuit. And I suppose we got to see Laguna and it's old in the way it should be seen, I guess.
Yeah. Although it's quite nice having a bit of fresh tarmac. has the car changed much since, I guess, it was launched?
Yeah, I mean, I guess these cars are called prototype for a reason, because they are always being developed. You know, in terms of the look of the car, they obviously haven't changed a massive amount from launch, but the underneaths have changed. That we are always iterating the performance of them, the different systems and things like that. So, you know, and all of those changes we offer back to the customers as upgrade paths and things like that. So, for example, you know, just the different drive throttle maps and things like that, just to make the car more drivable and thing, you know, that's always been iterated and worked on, and the more miles we do, the more we can learn. And so things like that we can easily give back to customers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mentioned that centrifugal clutch, for example. You know, we sell that as an upgrade kit for customers, so they can move to that. So all the developments that we do on the car, with it being a prototype, is always being constantly developed. We do then offer that back to the customers as well. And you know, we've now got a 427 model and a 500 model, which is the horsepower. We did have lower horsepower in the very early models, for example. Yeah. But we sold upgrade paths so people could upgrade to a, you know, from a 427 to a 500 if they wanted, for example. Yeah. And we've got a number of developments in the pipeline based on customer feedback. You know, we've now got some really experienced customers that own these cars and race them. And they'll feedback thoughts and opinions and as much as, you know, our development drivers do as well. We take all that on board and we've got a kind of development roadmap that we're always working on.
What sort of things?
I have to be a bit careful about what I can say. So I think I've already mentioned kind of the weight. You know, there's a big program of weight reduction, and that's everything from the carbon tub all the way through to the roll bar, the halo, things like that. We're working on different gearing and things like that. There will be different wheel size options in the future, again, because people might want it to handle slightly differently depending on their use. We're working on
the wheel sizes.
Yeah.
What does changing the wheel size do?
Well, I guess fundamentally it's about how much grip you can have at the rear. So, you know, some drivers like to have a lot more movement at the rear and others prefer less movement.
Width-wise.
Yeah, yeah, contact patch-wise. Wise. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing we're doing is also some developments on what we call an enduro pack. So we've got some customers, particularly statesides, that want to be doing 6-12-hour races, 24-hour races in some scenarios. And so, you know, the ideal car for that is a 427 because, one, you can get a lot more miles from a fuel tank, for example. You know, with a 427 you're not running a supercharger, so it's one less component and things like that. So we're doing some enduro development at the moment, so we can offer kind of customers an enduro kit if they want to go and do these long races and things like that. So yeah, it's developments like that.
Lights are possibly a bigger tank, those sorts of things.
Lights, bigger tank, dry fuel system, dry brake fuel system, so you can fill it up quickly. A bit of a bit more redundancy in ancillary parts, you know, so you'll have two of more of the ancillary things, so you can switch between systems if you get a fault and things like that.
Nice. I think I'm all for more time. Like if I could do a 6-hour race rather than a 30-minute race every single time, like just your chance of getting track time increases significantly. You don't just get someone, stuff it in the first corner and that's it. See you next weekend.
Yeah. Although it does amaze me, you know, you watch these endurance races and they are going for it. You know, they're not, no one's really thinking, they're still driving. Okay, maybe not 100%, but they're still certainly, I'd say 95% on it most of the time.
You're still on it. It's just purely a logistical situation. If someone crashes, there is time to take their car and get it off the track and keep racing. Whereas in a sprint, there just isn't time.
Yeah, it gets your safety car and you follow the safety car around. Exactly. Yeah.
Did you on the safety car, did you follow the changes at Le Mans this year with the safety car? So it's now like an American system.
Yeah.
Where you can all so what happens? So the safety car comes out, you can all line up, and if you're lapped as such, you can unlap.
Unlap.
That to me sounds like I get it, but I think it's rubbish in a 24-hour race.
It's kind of, how many times can you unlap yourself if you're six laps down? That's the question.
Yeah. Just like keep going, but like, stop the safety car for a minute. Right, now bring the safety car out again. So and so, just put it in the wall. We'll unlap. I guess it makes the racing tighter.
It was a fantastic race at Le Mans this year, though, wasn't it? You know, it was great to see a number of manufacturers competing in the top class for the win. It was, really good.
And then a bit of last minute bop.
Yeah.
So when the Revolutions are racing against other cars, do they? I don't know what they race in the States. You're saying this, the Sports Prototype Cup. Is there a similar sort of thing in the UK? Do they try and get cars of a similar sort of thing? Or it's like, well, if you're racing Revolutions, you're kind of racing against the Revolutions. Is that sort of how
So certainly in the UK or the European series, they kind of have a Revolution trophy. So you're in your own category, really. I mean, obviously, you always want to race the other manufacturers and things like that. But in terms of, you know, podium, you've got the Revolution Trophy podium and things like that. In the States, it's a little bit different. So they will classify cars in the same category. So you'll have like a Revolution and an SR10, for example.
Right,
In the same category racing against each other.
Pragas?
In the UK, you get Pragas. In the States, you don't. So you typically get things like a Wolf. You'll get Radicals, you'll get Revolutions in the UK. You typically get Pragas, Radicals, Revolutions. I think we had a Wolf actually in Barcelona, but yeah, you don't see Pragas in the series that we run in the States.
And are they must be pretty similar pace to the Revolution?
Yeah, very similar. So for example, at Silverstone, when I told you about Jonathan Mitchell jumping in the car, you know, he had a 30-minute lap for lap battle with a Praga, and they were you could see where each car was stronger in different parts of the circuit, and it made for really interesting watching actually. So you could see the different strengths of the cars, and it made for a great race. And they're very similar paced, and from one weekend to the other, it can really be down to the driver on who extracts the most from the car.
Where's a Revolution quicker than a Praga, and where's a Praga quicker than a Revolution?
Is a Praga a little bit? Well, Praga are lighter, so they're much more nimble through the quicker stuff. I'd say we've got more power down the straights, and our downforce is probably more usable through the medium and high speed stuff. So I'd certainly say through all the high speed and medium speed stuff, we were pulling away around Silverstone, and they were closing up through all the slow sections. So,
and they're slowly getting cooked.
Ah, man. I mean, I remember back to my GT times, you know, you got hot in a GT car. I can't even imagine how hot you get in a Prague, because the cockpit's so close
tiny
to you.
Tiny little cockpit with big ass engine just popping heat in.
I've never driven one, but it does look a bit like an oven, I must admit. So,
That is one thing that I, doing some, you know, having a Radical and driving a Radical, apart from having your head ripped off and then you get a little bit of aero stuff on your hat and realize that makes an unbelievable difference. You sort of forget about getting too hot. And then you get into something that's enclosed and you're like, hang on a minute. It's quite sweaty in here.
Yeah, I mean, in the States, we've had a number of customers that have come from LMP cars. So they've gone, you know, they're obviously wealthy guys, and they've looked and thought, well, I'll go with an LMP car. Yeah. And when I say a number, probably three or four that have gone, oh, I bought an LMP3 car, and actually, I just don't like the enclosed cockpit. And we're a really great avenue for those guys, because you know we can kind of give them the same technology and almost the same performance with an open cockpit. I think you've got to be a particular type of driver that can put up with a closed cockpit, and can be hot, I would think.
What do you see in the future of Revolution? I guess we talked a little bit about, you know, the cars evolving, the way it's coming off. Are there some series or things you'd like to see with Revolution moving forward?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got a very ambitious business plan. It sees us want to build into more territories. So at the moment, kind of the main territories where we've got dealers and race circuits are America, Canada, Europe, Korea. We're just about to launch Australia, so it hasn't been announced yet. Maybe by the time this podcast goes out, it might be announced. But we're just launching in Australia with a dealer and a team over there. So they're predominantly going to be focusing on track days to begin with. They'll build a customer base and then launch a series. And they've got a very good past history of doing that, building championships. So Australia is kind of the next one. But then we want to do more territories than that. But we'll just take a territory at a time, build a customer base and a race series, and then go from there. We'd love to support F1 races again. So something else we're working on. So we've supported F1 races in the past. Certainly our American teams are really keen, and our Canadian teams are really keen that we do that. So that would be, fantastic and something that we're trying to work on.
That sort of thing, getting on the card with other interesting race. I mean, F1's like, this is like the top, isn't it? You can be racing at an F1 weekend, I mean, happy days. Go watch your F1 and also go around the track. Like, brilliant.
Yeah. Incredibly. We've done Monza and Portimao with F1 before now. So it'd be great to do that. But yeah, so it's all about building more territories, but also making sure we're delivering the absolute best service we can to every territory we've got. So, we're still a small team, a very personal team. So, any owner, any dealer can pick up the phone and speak with Phil or James or myself, and we listen and take on board what they've got to say. In the States, for example, when they're racing, we go over and we send factory support. And if we can do what we're doing in our current territories, but help them do it more to a bigger size and develop new territories at the same time, then that's the plan.
Yeah, that'd be cool. What, slightly deviating, but what made you come and work for a car company from being in technology?
Being able to combine my passion of motorsport with my skills in business, I couldn't resist that opportunity. Really, the technology business I was CEO of, it was a listed business. We delisted it and sold it literally weeks before COVID. We were so lucky.
That's good timing.
Yeah, we had a board meeting in December 2019, and we were going through the risk register, and someone said, "This pandemic, should we consider it on the risk register?" And we were like, "No, don't. That won't come over to Europe. Don't be stupid." And 3 weeks later, we closed the deal, and 3 weeks after that, we were all in lockdown. And I just sat there and thought, "Wow, that was incredibly lucky." Yeah. when you're a CEO of a business like that, you're always selling and you're always doing the commercials, and being able to take what I learned on that and put it into motorsport and, work with someone like Phil and James, Phil Abbott and James Abbott. For those that don't know, Phil Abbott was one of the co-founders of Radical. His son, James Abbott, did a lot of the development on Radicals before they started Revolution. And, so to be able to work with two people of in the industry with their background is just fantastic, really. Not only learning a lot from them, but you can just be inspired by some of the ideas they have and the development they do. And you look at how great they got Radical and how they built that, and then they're just taking that to the next level with Revolution, and it's inspiring, really. So I didn't take much persuasion to say yes. I'll come and join.
Yeah, it's like, do you want to go and play with race cars? Yes, please.
Yeah. It's like, occasionally you can drive one. Can I? Brilliant.
Happy days.
And then when Phil said, "Well, it's really important that when you're selling a car that you can race it and you've got experience and you know about racing," I was like, "No problem at all. I'll do all the research you need me to do on that front."
Yeah, you're like, but I'm lacking a bit of current experience. I think I need to do at least a season. No, it's cool what they're doing, and I'm liking seeing how it's developing. I normally wrap these up with five questions.
Okay.
Are you ready? Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Yes. So I used to rally classic cars with my dad. I'll rewind it and tell you the full story. So I probably wasn't the most applied person at school.
Okay.
And when I say probably, really wasn't. And I left school and went to college and got an okay college, but went to university. And my dad said to me, look, if you go to university and get a good degree, we'll enter the Monte Carlo Rally together, which was a classic nice. Monte Carlo Rally. So that was good. That was good motivation for getting a good degree. So I left university with a first, and said to my dad, right, come on then, we're doing the Monte Carlo, aren't we? And so he stood by his word, and he bought a Triumph TR3A. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. We thought this thing wouldn't be very competitive. We thought it would be just kind of like a tour through the Alps and for anybody that knows classic rallying, it's quite the opposite. Actually, you've got ex rally drivers, extremely competitive, and you know, you have to drive very quickly. And anyway, so we were going up and didn't really know much about mountains or how the northeast side of a mountain is cooler than the southwest side of the mountain.
So we're
going up the southwest side of a mountain, going up the col very quickly, and we went through a tunnel and we exited the tunnel on the east side of the mountain, which was extremely snowy and icy, and we'd come up the nice sunny dry side. So we came through this tunnel, and as I came through this tunnel at about 55 miles an hour and the road went sharp left and down a hill, I quickly realized there was no chance we were going to make that corner. So I looked, and there was this row of trees, and I picked a tree and I aimed for the tree, and I made sure I got my headlights right in the middle of this tree. So we hit this tree. And we sat there, and my dad, who was navigating, looked at me and went, why the bloody hell did you do that? And I said, open the door, go and have a look the other side of the tree, and you'll soon realize why I did that. So he gets out, he looks over, looks down this huge mountain drop and goes, I can see why you aim for that tree. that's probably my most memorable experience of wasn't quite a road trip, but it was kind of a road trip, yeah.
That experience, like, because I've driven in that sort of area, not competitively, not very fast and whatever, but even just like straight driving to go skiing or whatever, you get that. It's like sunny on one side, and then you come out and you're like, oh, sheet ice and snow.
It was exactly that.
That sounds like quite a cool thing to be doing. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, sports car, what would it be?
Ferrari 308.
Ooh, why?
Yeah. When I was a kid, Magnum. Who didn't love and want to be Magnum? And even, you know, just driving those cars now, they sound amazing and look amazing. They're pretty slow. Yeah. I'd probably say a Ford Fiesta is probably quicker. You know, certainly if you pulled up to a traffic light, probably a modern Ford Fiesta would beat it off the line. Yeah. But yeah,
not quite giving you the experience though.
No, exactly.
You know, modern Ford Fiesta,
that gearbox, that you know, the way the engine sounds, you have to really be driving it. You have to be properly focused. Yeah, I'd probably say a Ferrari 308.
Yeah,
and actually, as far as goes, they're relatively affordable and serviceable. They're probably just before the crazily priced ones.
I would definitely say having the chance to drive things like, you know, the Revolution, Radical, that sort of stuff, it just ruins a lot of the idea of a track focused road car. It just goes out the window. You're like, well, why would I bother? That just makes no sense to drive that on track.
And the thrill and exhilaration you get from driving a Revolution, you know, the G forces, the how quickly you can take the corners. Yeah, you jump in a road car and take it around the track, and it just seems, yeah.
Yeah, like a boat. Yeah. Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter. No. Literally doesn't matter what it is.
No. It's funny because, like, your friends who don't do motorsport, they say, why is it so hard to drive in the rain on a racetrack? You know, on the roads, it's not that slippy. But it's when you take a car to the edge and, you know, it's just so slippy, isn't it? And people who don't drive on a track don't get it, I guess.
On a track in the wet, like, it has taken me a long time to get used to the fact that there's just a bunch of basically ice on the racing line.
Yeah, all the time.
That's the best way of describing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, all the time, remember.
Yeah. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
Revolution 500 SC. No.
Yours for base price of 160? Is that what they are?
Yeah. About 160, yeah. To be honest, nothing's that cheap these days, are they? You know, I'd say something like the old Land Rover Defender is a fantastic car and fun to drive, but even those are ridiculously priced now.
Is this also it's just a natural thing as you age, everything seems expensive? I know I genuinely feel like everything is expensive at the moment, but like, I also, part of me has to check myself and be like, yeah, but you think like a whatever, I don't know, a beer not costing £7 or something in London. You're like, yeah, it should be £2 as expensive. Yeah.
Well, I think when you've got family and kids, you just know that you've got to spend a load more on something else, haven't you? So it probably seems expensive because you know you've got to buy
five of them.
Yeah. So I've been terrible at answering this question, to be honest. I can't think of a car that should be a cheap car that should be valued more.
Okay. Well, that's all right.
Yeah.
If something pops into your head, let it up. Most interesting car. What are you Googling? What are you looking up? What are you thinking about?
You've got to say that. And it's not a road car, but that Ferrari that run Le Mans, the design of that car, you know, even when you look at the front wheel arches, you know, I do find that car extremely, extremely interesting. And yeah, it's not a road car, but one you could look at and take design cues from. And
yeah,
you know, not only did it win, but it looks just stunning.
It's a very cool looking thing. I'm looking forward to it. It's a shame. I can't not sort of see the Ferrari win with a little asterisk on it this year. And it was all super close. It was all like great racing, but there was just all this stuff that kind of happened behind the scenes and whatever that you're like.
With the balance of power and
balance performance and like the change of the safety car rules and all this sort of stuff. And you're like, ugh, we just, can there just be none of that? But then I think that's
doesn't KCO take away, whatever. It's still an amazingly good looking car.
Oh, yeah, exactly. If someone said, what would you want to drive? I have to lean towards the top end of prototypes. I'd love to drive an F1 car. Who wouldn't want to like drive an F1 car? But like, in terms of things I've sort of driven, I've not really driven a very fast single seater. So the idea of driving an LMP1 or a hypercar or something, or a hypercar in maybe a couple of years when they've developed them a little bit more and whatnot. It's just, I'd love to know what that is like.
Yeah.
It must just be absolutely loony.
Agreed.
Final question. Five car garage, unlimited value.
Ford Escort Mexico.
Nice. Any particular reason?
Oh, just because I think when I was growing up, they were amazing cars, and I still think they look brilliant now, and I imagine they're extremely good fun to drive.
Yeah.
I'd have to say a Mini Cooper S, the 60s. Again, for exactly the same reason, to drive the most amazing cars, you know, like a go-kart on the road, and you just continual grin with them.
See those at Goodwood, like, and just go, that looks like they're having a lot of fun.
Yeah. Any car that can consistently cock a wheel, then
fully lit the whole time, with varying degrees of slip.
I'd have to say a Ferrari F40.
Nice.
Again, I mean, they're probably a car that don't actually drive that amazingly. You know, the turbo lag on those were
pretty good.
But the look and everything about them.
Iconic.
Yeah. Modern, I guess, coming a bit more into the modern. I can't get away from the Bugattis, to be honest. You know, you know, just the level of technology and speed and everything that they've built into those cars. And it's probably more the technology marvel of them more than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that they've kind of maximized everything. And
you know, like, you know, they've spent so much time making sure they work.
Yep.
Like, not just getting the performance, because I think performance is relatively easy to get. Let's just put some asterisks on that. But in terms of these sorts of projects, you can get the horsepower. That is doable. It's making the horsepower work day in, day out, start it up in the cold, in a car park, reverse up a hill, all that sort of stuff with this insane performance. And I can't help but look at something like the Chiron and whatever and go, it's pretty mad.
Yeah. And then I guess the final one would be a Porsche 959, just because it was the biggest competitor to the F40. Nice. And same periods. Yeah. To have two of those in the garage.
It's slightly more practical. I guess a 959 is probably pretty practical, actually. It's a 911-ish. Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
No problem.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.